So I'm going to talk a bit about suicidal behavior and self-injury and some of the applications of my research, the research from my group, to clinical practice. Now, I'm going to talk a lot about the research, and then when I wrap up, I'll talk about how it applies to clinical practice, because I wanted to give you a taste of what we're doing these days. So I did really want to talk about, just mention the support that I've had. I've been very lucky and very grateful to have the support from NIH. And I want to mention that Lilly gave me the drug from the study that I'm going to be talking about. Okay, so I'm going to tie in this presentation a biobehavioral, clinical, and biological research on borderline personality disorder and how an experimental psychopathology approach can advance our understanding. And then I want to interweave with this the basic research on suicidal behavior in BPD and really talk about how it differs from suicidality in the context of major depression. And then finally, suggest ways that the basic findings can be integrated into studying mechanisms of treatment efficacy and its application to clinical work, and then kind of tie it all in with some ways that we can apply these findings to our clinical practices. So, as people mentioned earlier, I'm not going to review the criteria, but I'm going to just focus on the criteria I have highlighted here. The criteria I have highlighted here: recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures, threats, or self-mutilating behavior. There is a move to not call it self-mutilation anymore. I'm going to refer to it here pretty much as non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. So I won't go through this, but I just want to point out the second to the last line here, that 9% of psychiatric emergency room visits were for borderline personality disorder. I think it's really important. And then to talk a little bit about the morbidity of BPD, but if you look at the last line here, that people with borderline personality disorder had more severe illness at their emergency room visit, this is the same study, but were less likely to be hospitalized. And so the question is, why? Is that good? Is that bad? What is that about? Because if you look at the morbidity of borderline personality disorder, it's pretty severe. It's very serious. So borderline personality disorder, especially co-occurring with major depression, is associated with the high suicide risk. Suicide attempts occur at a very high rate. And in clinical samples, and I stress this is clinical samples because epidemiological samples or community samples show a different picture, up to 80% of people report a suicide attempt history. This is the list of co-occurring disorders. One of the disorders that I have up there that people don't necessarily think about in relation to borderline are panic and anxiety disorders. A lot of my patients have tremendous anxiety. Okay, so the high-risk nature of borderline, nearly 10% completion rate for people with borderline personality disorder. Of all completed suicide, 9 to 33% are by individuals with borderline personality. So if you kind of flip it around, they make up a large population, a large percentage of the population of people who kill themselves. When you kind of put this in with the fact that they're more severe at their ED presentation, they're less likely to get hospitalized, and they are very likely, there's a large percentage of people who have this disorder who end up killing themselves. Like, how do all of those balls stay up in the air? Non-suicidal self-injury, up to 75% of individuals who have borderline have hit, cut, burned themselves, or otherwise self-injured. The thing that I'll mention here is that we often think about self-injury as cutting, and maybe to a lesser extent burning. But one of the things that people do a lot, but you don't hear about unless you ask them, is they hit themselves. They bang their heads, they hit their heads. They take objects and they hit themselves. And so it's something that I actually didn't realize until I really started explicitly asking about this. So this is just an example, again, like Alec mentioned earlier, to kind of give some life to who the person is that we're talking about here when I put up all of these numbers. This is a verbatim transcript from a patient. The world came crashing around me last week. My boyfriend of 12 months informed me that he no longer loved me. I had clung to him as if my very existence depended on him, even though he treated me badly. I guess my clinging was just too much, and I was getting angry too often. It was not until now that I realized how severe my problems are. All I can think is, stupid, incompetent, worthless, horrible person. As I listened to my boyfriend telling me that he didn't want to see me anymore, all I can remember is feeling numb. I wanted to jump out the window or crash my car. I left, got into my car, drove home, took whatever pills I had in my home. After an hour, I didn't feel like I was dying, so I cut my wrist and watched the blood drip. I felt that I couldn't live without him in my life. It isn't that I didn't want to go on. I felt that I couldn't. And so this was an actual narrative of a patient. And I think if you've worked with people who have borderline personality disorder, if you are one or you know one, you know what this experience is. So if we look at non-suicidal self-injury, as I mentioned just a minute ago, the typical behaviors are cutting, burning, hitting oneself, or headbanging. And it's distinct from suicidal behavior, but it's a major risk factor for suicide attempts. And so although people who do non-suicidal self-injury can say this is different, this is not a suicide attempt, it's self-injury, it is the biggest risk factor for suicidal behavior. And why that is, I mean, there are different theories about some, you know, once you cross a barrier towards hurting yourself, does it then give you kind of a permission to go on to the next level? I'm going to talk a little bit about suicidal behavior in the context of borderline personality disorder as a self-regulating and emotion-regulating behavior. And so perhaps that's why. From 55 to 85% of self-injurers, this is again, in a clinical sample, have made at least one suicide attempt. So before I go on, I just want to kind of take a step back and look at where we were with borderline personality disorder to really appreciate where we are now and how fast the field is moving and how strongly our ideas about it and our research has changed. So and these actually are quotes. I didn't put the authors next to them because I thought they were a bit embarrassing. But these are actual quotes. I just went to the literature, pulled out a bunch of quotes. Borderline still means different things to different people, still tends to be a wastebasket diagnosis and should not be used. The families of borderline patients were distinguished by the rigid tightness, this is a quote, of the marital bond to the exclusion of the attention, support, or protection of the children. This pattern of neglect by the mother results in borderline personality in the children. Mothers of borderline tended to conceive of their children egocentrically as need-gratifying objects rather than as individuals with distinct evolving personalities. And so the next part is my idea there, the borderline aphrenogenic mother. And where I got that from, the idea is the schizophrenogenic mother, right? So what was the schizophrenogenic mother? The icebox was, I don't remember if it was icebox or was the cold and or over-involved mother in who caused schizophrenia in her child. The diagnosis of borderline does not exist. These patients can best be considered, this comes from my own institution, atypical depressives. Treating the depression successfully resolves most of the symptoms of borderline personality disorder. And the suicide attempts in borderline patients are purely manipulative and therefore not really suicidal. And finally, the primary motive for cutting is attention seeking. Now, the last one I really love because for the most part, it's a hidden behavior. So it's the most hidden behavior to be attention seeking. In other words, people who cut themselves are very ineffective with the way that they get it, that they seek attention. So this is where we were not that long ago. These are quotes anywhere from 5 to 10 years ago. And so now where we're moving is we're looking at the genetics of borderline personality disorder. And I won't talk about this anymore because Scott Wilson, who works with me, will be talking about this tomorrow. But we're now looking at, well, what are the traits that make somebody vulnerable to borderline personality? And so we're really kind of shifting away and coming into the latter half of the 20th century. So the way that our group has been tackling this problem, and I have to say I have this wonderful group of people who I work with at Psychiatric Institute that makes it so much easier to do this kind of work. And some of what I'm going to be talking about here today is the work of Eric Furtug, who is a young investigator who works in our group. So how should we investigate what drives and perpetuates the debilitating symptoms and high-risk behaviors? And so what we've been doing is taking an experimental psychopathology approach. So this simply looks at the mechanisms of psychopathology that are tested based on a theoretical model of a disorder. We use experimental research designs, so then we can look at alterations in basic processes that drive symptoms that are either neurobiological or cognitive, social, and so forth. So what's the advantage of this kind of approach? This is not, you know, a particularly novel approach, but it evaluates theories of psychopathology using performance-based measures and neurobiological measures. And it complements descriptive approaches. In other words, it's moving away from just simply being descriptive, which is still some of what we do, by focusing on underlying mechanisms of symptoms. So now, what are the implications for this, for treatment development and evaluation? There are now several treatments for borderline personality disorders with varying levels of empirical support from randomized trials. However, if you have efficacy in a randomized controlled trial, it doesn't elucidate why a treatment led to clinical change or how that change came about. And without changes in the basic processes that underlie the symptoms, therapeutic gains may be fragile. So in other words, we're trying to begin to move towards understanding why a treatment works, not just that it does work. And so this kind of approach enables us to do that. So why would we do this? Even the most efficacious treatments for borderline may not work for all individuals. So we need to coordinate the study of mechanisms of the disorder with mechanisms of treatment. And so that's kind of where we're going. So the symptoms, as has been said earlier today, of borderline personality disorder can kind of be classified into these three groups: disturbed interpersonal relatedness, behavioral instability, and emotional instability. Now, we've been working in all three areas, but I'm just going to talk about the disturbed interpersonal relatedness work that we've been doing. So this was a slide that Scott Wilson helped me to make up. And so this is, so if we take now, we move towards looking at, say, we look at the disturbed interpersonal relatedness. So what would we do in order to study this? What are the means of assessing this? And so if you want to take a laboratory approach to this that has validity, so you can look at rejection sensitivity, you can look at social stress paradigms, you can look at trust paradigms. And so this is the way that we have been working. And similarly, if you look at behavioral dysregulation, you can, the endophenotype here would be impulsive aggression, and you could look at assessments that that tap this. So it would be things like the no-go, go-no-go, or the Iowa gambling task. And for affect dysregulation, the endophenotype could be emotional sensitivity. And I say could be because this is just a best guess. And here you can look at HPA, axis dysfunction, autonomic dysfunction. And then I put down at the bottom there pain threshold and tolerance. And I'm talking about physical pain because it doesn't really actually belong there, but it's something that kind of is hanging out there with this disorder that is a little bit confusing. It's not confusing, it's just like a piece of the puzzle that doesn't fit into these clusters so neatly. And there's a lot of evidence that there's something altered with pain threshold in the disorder. Okay, so this is the cluster that I'm going to focus on. So the three approaches that we've been using are looking at the HPA axis. So we're looking at reactivity to social stress, social cognition of facial emotion recognition, and rejection sensitivity. Okay, so I won't get into this. This is just how the HPA axis works. And so what we've been doing is giving the Trier, a modified version of the Trier social stress test. And what the Trier does is it's a laboratory-based test in which you give a mild social stress to somebody. And so what it has been found to do is to elicit changes in salivary cortisol and emotional state that goes along with that and some cardiovascular parameters. But and so what the Trier does is you have somebody come into the room and they have to give, there are different variations of this. They give a speech about either some aspect of themselves, something about their personal life, something about as though they were applying for a job. People have done it in a variety of ways. And then usually some kind of impossible mathematical test. And so it gets a stress response. It moves anxiety up. And what we did was we have a little bit of a less stressful version than was originally designed. Since we were using it in vulnerable people, and we had a parallel study going on that was using it in kids, and so we wanted to be very careful about what we did. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some of the results of this. So in this, what we did was, this is just some preliminary results. We have a lot more data that we have analyzed. And so we looked at changes in negative emotion for people who had borderline personality disorder and people who had major depression with no borderline personality disorder. So we were comparing two psychiatric groups. And you can see that they look the same, right? They're both feeling negative emotions over the course of the test. So at the beginning, they were feeling a little bit anxious, a little bit negative emotions. It went up, and then at the end, it came down. Changes in heart rate in the same. They also they're looking pretty much the same. Now, what is interesting here is that the cortisol response is different. In this, you could see the lower line, which is a lower peak in the cortisol response, is people with major depression who do not have borderline. And so the people with borderline personality disorder went way up in their stress response than the cortisol response. And if you also look at this, it's at 50 minutes, it's still up there. It's still up beyond where the people with major depression were at their highest point. And so if you think to Marsha Linehan's idea about this kind of not returning to baseline, you know, in terms of emotional reactivity, this very much neatly parallels that you go up if the person goes up, and then it takes a longer line to return down after an emotional stress. And so if you're still up there and the next emotional stress, whatever it is, comes along and you haven't returned back down, you're up even higher. And so these results kind of go along with that idea. Okay, so So that's one piece of evidence that we have that says, okay, so there is, what is puzzling a little bit about this is that the negative emotions at this point in this preliminary data are not really tracking with the cortisol response. And so that's a bit of a puzzle that we're going to look at in our next pass at the data when we have more subjects. Okay, so this next thing that I'm going to talk about, and this again is looking at the interpersonal dimension of borderline personality disorder. And this was Eric Fertug's idea, and I just think it was it's a really interesting bit of research that's coming out of looking at this. So if you look at this, there's a test called Reading the Mind in the Eyes. And what this test is just pictures, a series of pictures of eyes with four words that describe the eyes. What is the expression in the eyes? And so you look at this first picture there. So what is the answer? It could be playful, irritated, comforting, or bored. So what is the answer there? Does anybody want to take a guess? Playful, yes. So we purposely picked an easy one there. So who doesn't do well on this test? People with autism. They don't get it. And so they cannot read the mind in the eyes. They have a lot of trouble. And so there's been a lot of discussion and some articles about whether people with borderline personality disorder are similar. You know, they're constantly reading negative where there isn't negative. And so Eric gave this test to people who have borderline personality disorder and controls. And guess what? They did better. He's since replicated it and separated it out by the type of picture. If you again look at the scores, the difference, these are not small differences. People with borderline personality disorder consistently do better on this test. So what does that mean? I think it goes along with what Anthony was saying before when he was talking about the therapist shifting in their chair and moving, or the patient, you know, saying, what is that expression on your face? Because they may be accurately detecting you're a little bored, you're a little disinterested, your mind is wandering. The way that I have thought about these results is that maybe people with borderline personality disorder can read things that we're not supposed to be able to read. You know, that they're just too accurate. They have too much of a fine tuning in their ability to sense. But that's just one thought about these results. So, Eric looked at this and asked, is being abused responsible for making individuals with BPD more tuned into affects? And actually, no. This was irrespective of whether somebody had an abuse history or not. One of the students who worked with us took the data and looked at it a little bit differently. And what seems to be happening in this is that there seems to be some kind of mediation through anxiety. That more anxious people are more accurate. Okay, so if we now shift to looking at rejection sensitivity, which is another aspect of the interpersonal dimension, right? When people who have borderline personality disorder, we know are very, and the reason that I'm particularly focusing on this is when I come to talk about suicidal behavior, it becomes really important. Are sensitive. People with BPD are sensitive to rejection. And what is perceived as a rejection by somebody with BPD sometimes is what somebody else would just kind of pass off as, oh, well, that person's having a bad day, or that person forgot, you know. Geraldine Downey developed a measure, a simple questionnaire of rejection sensitivity. She's at Columbia, this is a fairly well-established measure looking at expectations of rejection from others. And so what we did was we administered this measure to three groups and compared their total scores. And so we had people with borderline personality disorder, people who had major depression, and people who had controls, who were controls, and looked at them. And as you would, this is not a surprising result, but we wanted to then include this in other studies, so we wanted to make sure that, in fact, it was relating to borderline. And you could see that, in fact, the people with borderline personality had the highest scores. The other issue that is being looked at is, what do we look at? What do we see when we see neutral faces? So this has to do with looking at basic issues of trust. So the instructions that are given to people for this paradigm are: the following pictures show faces of different men and women. In this study, we're interested in finding out how looks or facial features influence people's opinions and their reactions. The differences are subtle, and can you interpret the facial expressions, what they say about each person? Okay, so these, though, have all been judged to be neutral faces. So the people who are doing the study don't know that these are neutral faces. And so what we did was correlate rejection sensitivity and measures of people how they rated the faces. And so rejection sensitivity was related to how trustworthy somebody was rated, what a bad character they had, and how cold they were. And so you could see these are very charged emotions, but not, for example, how dull they were. So it wasn't just like that they were rating everybody in a negative fashion there is something about then when you're in a neutral situation, when the cues aren't there, that something seems to be going wrong. So this is a task that Eric is beginning to work on, to get going now, in terms of comparing how people with borderline personality do compared to normals. And so these are faces that morph from trustworthy to untrustworthy. And this is just, we don't really have results. I just want to give you an idea of what happens. And so then you have to react to how soon do you see this face as untrustworthy or trustworthy. And so this is just, you know, early on when Eric started to look at this, the borderline participants were slow to react for trustworthy and fast to react for untrustworthy. So that kind of tells you, like, we're trying to really, like, not just say that there is this dimension of interpersonal disturbance, but what does this dimension mean? What are the kind of like, what are the dimensions of this dimension? I want to take this and see, and try to understand how these findings aid our understanding and treatment of suicidal behavior and non-suicidal self-injury in borderlines. So I am interested in this because these behaviors occur: suicide attempts and non-suicidal self-injury occur very often in the context of borderline personality disorder. And for me, the question is why? Why is that? You probably have all your answers, but we actually don't have an answer. And so these are some of the questions that, in my mind, follow just from that basic question. And so I wonder if suicidal behavior in the context of borderline personality disorder is different than this same behavior in the context of other diagnoses. And I'm going to present some evidence that says, yes, it is different. There's something different about this. Does it have a different phenomenology? In other words, what are the after effects of a suicide attempt in borderline? And I'll tell you the answer for, if you have worked with borderline patients, you know that they often feel better. And I don't mean somebody who makes a suicide attempt who has borderline personality disorder feels great, but it's there is a kind of restorative value that suicide attempts can have, so that their equilibrium seems to be restored. Is the behavior less serious? Do the precipitants for the behavior differ? Are they interpersonal versus non-interpersonal? And is there a different biology for suicidal behavior in borderline, or a lack of a biological basis for it in borderline? And so here's the question, it's a little confusing. Is suicidal behavior in borderline personality disorder more similar to non-suicidal self-injury than to suicidal behavior that we see in depression? So if we ask the question, so if you were to take somebody who is suicidal and has borderline personality disorder, does this behavior look more like the suicide attempt and the circumstances surrounding it of somebody who makes a suicide attempt, say in the context of major depression? Or does it look like more like a non-suicidal self-injury? And I don't mean that it's not, that there isn't intent, but I'm talking about the circumstances leading up to it, the function that it serves, and how people feel afterwards. And if that's so, what in the world does that mean? So just to stress that this is a serious problem, but also Turecki's group has suggested that people who kill themselves who have borderline personality disorder may not just be the average person who has borderline personality disorder. These are people, so their group did this psychological autopsy study, and they found that they really did differ in important ways. And it's really interesting because this kind of parallels the rest of the literature on suicide. They had fewer hospitalizations, they had made fewer suicide attempts, but they had more current and past substance abuse, and they had more impulsivity and aggression. And so if one of the things that is a problem in the suicidology literature is that when you study suicide attempts or people who make suicide attempts as a kind of a proxy for people who commit suicide, it's a bit of a problem, it's a bit of a stretch, because most of the people who kill themselves never make a suicide attempt. And so this seems to be following that same pattern. So this is a piece of data, a study that we did. This was with Beth Brodsky, one of my colleagues. So what we did was we compared profiles of individuals with borderline personality disorder who made suicide attempts, and we compared them to people with major depression who made suicide attempts who didn't have borderline personality disorder. So again, this is beginning to try to figure out, okay, so is this the same group? Do they look the same? Do they look different? So their first attempt was made at an earlier age. This shouldn't be surprising to you. They made more frequent attempts. Their most lethal attempt is as lethal as their depressed counterparts. Now, often that's surprising to clinicians, that the image of people who have borderline personality disorder and who make suicide attempts is they're like these minor, you know, two pills, four pills, they're nothing kind of attempts. But actually, when their most lethal attempt is just as lethal. The trigger for their attempts are much more likely to be interpersonal. And these do not have to be strong interpersonal precipitants like my child died. This is, we're talking about, you know, relatively minor interpersonal precipitants. Somebody I was dating for, 1 month decided he didn't want to go out with me anymore. And so there, now, and here is like, here are the things that get confusing. Their intent, although the lethality is the same as the depressed counterparts, their intent is lower. So they say they don't want to kill themselves as much as people who have depression. And their perception of lethality is lower. And so they're doing things that are, they're misjudging how damaging what they're doing is. And so the actual lethality is the same as major depression. Their intent is lower. And so you have like kind of people playing with fire a little bit. And this occurs in the context of when you look at who people with borderline personality disorder are, they have higher levels of hostility, higher levels of impulsivity, and higher levels of aggression, all very kind of negative markers for putting somebody at risk for killing themselves. So this, I think, is part of why the seriousness of suicide attempts in the context of borderline personality disorder can be misjudged. There is this kind of combination of high frequency of attempts, minor interpersonal triggers that shouldn't make anybody suicidal, lower intent, lower perceived lethality. And so you could see how it could be misjudged. And so you get the higher frequency of attempts gets people who are the caregivers, and that's the family members and the treaters, in the kind of the boy who cried wolf mentality. And so there can be a tendency to discount because, oh, that's just another suicide attempt. Yet, if you look at the bottom, the lethality ends up being just as high as people who have major depression. So then to begin to address this question about are suicide attempts in borderline personality disorders more similar to self-injury than they are to suicide attempts in major depression, we started to look a little bit at, and we've collected more data on this, and this is just a preliminary, some preliminary results that one of our, the students who worked with us took a look at some of our data. And so if you look at what is the typical experience after non-suicidal self-injury, and these are pretty much what people say, right? That there is a sense of relief. They describe a kind of a homeostasis after it happens. And in other words, a kind of a restored equilibrium. And so we seem to think that it serves an emotion regulation function. The typical experience after a suicide attempt in the context of a major depression is disappointment, hopelessness, and sometimes an increase in the level of depression. It's like, I can't even do this right. So what's the typical experience after a suicide attempt in the context of borderline personality disorder? Charlene Yuan's thesis looked at this. And what she found is when she compared people who had borderline personality disorder and made a suicide attempt versus people with major depression, what people with borderline personality disorder talked about was that what the suicide attempt did for them was it gave them an escape, it distracted them from their problems, and it gave them emotional relief. And that's different than the people with major depression. Interestingly, they didn't differ when it came to trying to have interpersonal influence. In other words, to get back at somebody, to have somebody pay more attention to them. You would think that that was what would come out as higher for borderline personality disorder, but it didn't. And to generate feelings. So major depression and borderline personality disorder look the same. So this to me is saying, oh, so if it's emotional relief, maybe we have something here that it is more similar to a self-injury than it is to a depressed suicide attempt. And when you look at this, just to kind of point out these data, I didn't say this earlier, but these are all people who have made suicide attempts. And so if we begin to say, okay, so maybe what we're doing here, and this we have to collect and analyze our groups of people who didn't attempt suicide, but is it possible that this has to do with this difference in cortisol response, has to do with a difference in the kind of the pathway for suicidal behavior in these two disorders? And again, here now, just briefly looking at how are borderline people who have borderline personality disorder different from people who have major depression. And I won't get into this too much, but basically what you can distinguish here is that the patterns are different, are the same, but they look, but they're the borderline attempters and non-attempters are more elevated. But what seems to distinguish borderline individuals with borderline personality disorder from people who have just major depression is that they're more impulsive. And then these data then go on to show that what distinguishes attempters from non-attempters is that they have different levels of aggression. And so it then goes back to, okay, so what's the commonality here between major depression attempts, borderline attempts, and what are the differences? Okay, so now I want to just switch for a minute to talk about non-suicidal self-injury. And this is just, I'll just give you one little idea about where we're going with this, is we were looking at, somebody mentioned before something about adrenaline and self-injury. But I was thinking about this from the perspective of endorphins and the runner's high. And so we looked at cerebrospinal fluid levels of endorphins and associated opioids in people who self-injure for people who don't. And it's really interesting, but we're finding altered levels. Now, so you could say, well, you don't know if it happened before or after the self-injury. Who knows? But it could be that people who have self-injury have lower levels, and because of those lower levels, they are trying, the self-injury in some way has a way of bringing up levels to a more normal level. So that's what we're thinking about there. And the reason that I'm mentioning this here is because I want to talk about this at the end when I talk about medications. And then one other example of how people with borderline personality disorder are different and then that may have an impact on their suicidal behavior is we looked at how do people with borderline personality disorder experience their depression. And so this was something that Scott Wilson and I did. I think it was the first thing that he worked on in our group. And so we compared people with major depression with people with both major depression and borderline personality disorder. And so what we found in this is that people with borderline personality for equal amounts of objectively rated depression, and so this is the blue bar there, is the Hamilton depression scale. That's rated by the clinician. And so you could see that the clinician judges these guys to be just about the same. And then we had the patients fill out the Beck Depression Inventory, which is a self-report. And for equal amounts of clinician-rated depression, the people with borderline personality disorder were having a much worse affective experience. And so there's something about this. So could it be that people with borderline personality disorder are overreporting? Are they underreporting? Are the clinicians underreporting? We don't know, but what we do know is that there seems to be something about experiencing this in just a more intense way. So if I were just to summarize this piece, before I move on to talk a little bit about treatment in the context of these basic findings, the basic findings are that deficits in borderline personality disorder are more fine-grained than originally thought. So it isn't just like they see negative all over the place, or they can't perceive what's negative and positive in somebody's reactions. They have greater accuracy in perception of facial expressions. They have somewhat more negative, more attribution of negative emotions in the face of neutrality, so neutrality is a problem. They have a stronger cortisol response under social stress. They have a heightened experience of negative mood, and non-suicidal self-injury may have a particular neurobiological basis. And that suicidal behavior in the context of borderline personality disorder appears to be different. It feels like it's something different than the kind of the model that we have of the depressed suicide attempt. So now if I can shift gears for the few minutes I have in the remainder of my talk and just talk about a little bit about treatment applications. And so we're working on now trying to do some mechanism research. And there is a quote by Kasdan last year to the following: discussions in theory about why psychotherapy changes people are plentiful, but supportive evidence is quite rare. And I think that this is really true. We know very little about why what works works. We know little enough about what works, but we know even less about why whatever works works. So here are just some of the treatments that were mentioned earlier about what are the treatments with empirical support. And so these are some of the questions that we're interested in. Do these treatments work in the same way? Do they work better for subtypes of patients? Do they work better for different symptoms? And is their efficacy sustained at different rates? So there's a lot of other questions we could be asking. And so the one study that we looked at that we've done so far compared dialectical behavior therapy with supportive therapy. I'm not going to talk much about those findings, but I'm just going to use it kind of as an illustration of where we're going with our work. And so we had we had well-trained supportive psychotherapists who were used a manualized treatment that was by they were supervised by a very experienced expert in supportive psychotherapy. And so what we looked at were, like, as I started looking at this, once we got some of our findings, it's like, well, what are the similarities between dialectical behavior therapy and supportive therapy? You would say, oh, geez, they're so different. But actually, when you sit down and you look at them, there's actually quite a bit of similarities. And so here were some of the similarities. So there was ongoing tracking of suicidal and self-injurious urges. So this was specifically for people who were suicidal and who self-injured. There were specific strategies for handling these urges. In other words, there was safety planning. The therapists had clear models of what it was they were doing. They were working with a manualized treatment. Both sets of therapists had a supportive and non-judgmental stance. They all had an optimistic attitude. Both from very different stances, but they both supportive psychotherapy and dialectical behavior therapy have an optimistic attitude. Both focus on the here and now, and they both focus on developing enhanced coping strategies now for the problems you're tackling now. The difference that I just noted here is that in supportive psychotherapy, the patient actually has to do more work because they have to generate the strategies themselves, in contrast to dialectical behavior therapy. So what we found, though, is that if we look at suicide events, that, and you know, we're not talking about a lot of events here. This was a, you know, we had 90 patients enrolled, and this is just looking at suicide attempts and hospitalizations because somebody was at risk of making a suicide attempt. Our therapist had a very high tolerance for suicidal behavior because everybody came into the study being acutely suicidal. And so you can see that there is some difference here between, this is a significant difference between DBT and supportive therapy. And the question is why, with all of these commonalities. So, but more importantly, although there is this difference here, many other factors that we looked at did not differ between the two groups. And so that there were lots of ways that both of them did equally well. You know, there was an effective time, people got better over time, and then, but there were ways in which they both did well. And so that started me going backwards and looking at, okay, so what did we do that was common across these that might have independent effects on the suicidal behavior and self-injury? And so this then started me thinking about shifting from straightforward efficacy to understanding moderators and mediators of outcome, like why and for whom. And so I'm going to just show you this because it just illustrates how we're thinking about this. So this is what we looked at. If we had people who were either on fluoxetine or on placebo. Now, this doesn't look too good for fluoxetine here, so you know for sure Lilly didn't give me any drug money, any money, so other than the drug. And so you can see that almost all of our suicide events, both attempts and hospitalizations for suicidal behavior, occurred on fluoxetine. And so that started us thinking, why? Why did that happen? Now, most of this can be explained that almost all of these events occurred when they were on very high doses of fluoxetine. And so on a moderate to low dose of fluoxetine, and in DBT, we had almost no, if you just took that separate group and looked at DBT and low-dose fluoxetine, there were almost no attempts. So we started looking at impulsivity. But so what we did was we just looked at people who made suicide attempts, people who were on fluoxetine, and to try to predict who made suicide attempts, to try to begin to understand that. And so what we found was that people at baseline who started out with higher baseline levels of impulsivity were more likely to make suicide attempts, and not surprisingly, people who had higher suicide ideation were more likely to make suicide attempts. So I'm just going to finish up here. So how do these findings inform our clinical practice? Individuals with borderline personality disorder may be more, not less, accurate in their perception and the emotions of others. So if we're the therapist, we ought to be thinking if the person is accusing us of being inattentive or being distracted or being upset, we ought to be thinking about, oh, so am I? Interpersonal sensitivity in borderline personality disorder is important to attend to. Consequences are dire. In other words, if we look at that, what were their precipitants to suicide attempts? It was interpersonal. Suicidal behavior in borderline personality disorder may look different than other diagnoses, but is just as serious. If endogenous opioid findings are confirmed, we may need to look to other classes of medications for help. So what I've been thinking is it may not be that medications don't work well for borderline personality disorder, but we just may not be looking at the right class of drugs, or the drugs may not yet be discovered. And so if we were to say what are the key elements for suicidal and self-injuring patients, ongoing monitoring of suicidality. Many patients have a don't ask, don't tell attitude. In other words, if you don't ask them if they made a suicide attempt or they self-injured or they're feeling acutely suicidal, they don't tell you. And then to have specific strategies for coping with suicidal urges, Greg Brown and I have developed a safety plan manual that is actually used in all of the Veterans Administration at this point for suicidal individuals. And this is, if you want, you can just email me and I will give you a copy of our manuscript that we have submitted that really describes what are internal, that's a specific written document that goes from internal strategies of coping all the way down to going to the emergency room, and everything is written out. Have a roadmap and have a collaborative agreement on what the destination is and what the detours are. Be comfortable with saying yes and be comfortable with saying no. And I think that goes along with, that's a simple way of saying what Anthony said earlier. Identify deficits explicitly is better than implicitly, and develop strategies, compensations, adaptations, and acceptance of all of those. And then I'll just end here, and I want to, this is the research team who has worked with us. It's cast of thousands, but this work couldn't be done without them. Thank you.